Labour got a landslide with only 34% of the vote. The popular vote and the size of their representation in Parliament is way out of kilter. They're not speaking for the working people. If you go through the ranks of Labour MPs these days, everybody's got a degree. You'd be hard-pressed to find four or five plumbers or electricians. It's been a complete inversion. You know, now, for instance, if you have a plumber or you get picked up by a taxi driver, you just assume they're voting Conservative, and you are 99% of the time right.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Nick Cater. Nick, welcome to the show.
Great to be here again, Brendan.
It's great to have you back on, not least because we need to work out what's going on in Australia. You've had your federal election. Labour has won, the Labour Party has won, and Anthony Albanese is back as Prime Minister, which it's fair to say some people were surprised by that. The Liberal Party, Peter Dutton's Liberal Party, did not do very well. So it looks like Australians are stuck with the status quo, and watching it from afar, it's hard to work out what's really going on, because some people are saying this is a great tub-thumping victory for Labour, other people are saying, actually, there's interesting stuff going on under the surface. What's your overview of what the Australian people said in that election?
Well, first, and I hope this doesn't cause people to switch off, but I don't know either what went on, frankly, Brendan, and I'm here. Look, it was the most extraordinary election, the most unpredictable election I've ever been involved with in Australia or indeed Britain. And that's the only bit I got right. You know, in predicting the result, I said very clearly and firmly it would be the most unpredictable election I'd ever covered. But I then boldly went on to predict that I thought Labour would win, but in minority. They would have to govern in partnership with the Greens, and the Liberals would pick up seats, because it seemed certain to me that they were ahead in quite a number of outer metropolitan and regional seats. Because what you've got, the fundamental divide, of course, as in Britain, is between the inner city elites in the sort of woke bubble and what I call real people, you know, people who do real jobs and don't spend all day on Twitter. So that's the broad divide. But I'd say two more things. It's complicated here very much, as in Britain, but in a different way, in that we don't just have two parties anymore. You know, the last time we had a landslide government, the last landslide was 2013, which was Tony Abbott for the Liberal Party. From memory, I think he had about 45 or 46% of the popular vote. So that seems quite reasonable in our system, that if you get almost half the popular vote, you should have a landslide. This time, Labour got a landslide with only 34% of the vote. So in that sense, it's very like Britain and very like Keir Starmer, in that you've got a complete the popular vote and the size of their representation in Parliament is way out of kilter. They'll have twice as many MPs or more than the Liberal coalition, but only 4% more of the popular vote. So we've got that problem here, that our idea of a representative democracy is under challenge. And just like Keir Starmer, I think Labour here will face the challenge that feels like they've got the whole country behind them, but they have to remember it's only one third and that they've got to be governing extra carefully because of that.
So, yeah, I think that's a really important stat, that Labour is back in power on 34% of the vote. So it's not...
Put that in perspective. 34%, I think, is either their fourth or maybe fifth lowest vote ever since 1901. And let's say too that the Liberal Party are also on the smallest vote ever. They're down to 31 or 32%, which is crazy, because they used to lose elections with 44 or 45. So this is a relatively new recent phenomenon. It's only, you only go back four or five elections and you have a different picture. So to have a three-way contest is very interesting, and we should make the comparison with Canada, but we can talk about that later on.
Yeah, and as you say, it is similar to Keir Starmer's so-called landslide here in the UK, which was less a landslide than a kind of a trickle, a kind of anti-Tory trickle. People were sick and tired of the Conservative Party that had been in power for 14 years, and He took a punt on Keir Starmer, but not with much enthusiasm, and he rode to power on not a very significant number of votes. And it seems a similar thing has happened in Australia. Is there recognition of that within the Labour camp or within the kind of Labour-leaning press? When they look at the fact that it's 34% that Anthony Albanese got, and that's what's put him back in power, and as you say, it's the fourth or the fifth lowest vote that Labour has ever had. Is there a recognition in that camp that this is, you know, we've won, but we might be losing in the long term? How are they talking about it?
Absolutely zero. I mean, we're only, 4 or 5 days out from the election, and you've got to allow them their little moment of celebration. I mean, it's been a very unexpected win. Let me say that almost nobody predicted this majority Labour government of this size. Almost all the polls were way out. So we've got that same problem that we have nowadays, that polling is very hard, and it's very hard to poll when you've got three parties in the race and not always the same three parties. So yeah, it's almost like 150 micro-elections. We've got 150 seats rather than one general election. But yeah, Labour, I think, look, it's early days. Let's see what happens when they calm down. But I think the danger for them is that they won't calm down, and they'll go in just commanding majority in Parliament, thinking they can do whatever they want. And they'll overstep, they'll go too far. I mean, parties almost always do that. So that'll be the opening for the Liberal Party and the coalition next time around.
You know, one of the reasons I was surprised by Labour's victory, however non-stunning it might be in historical terms, is that Albanese is, in my view, not a very good prime minister, and has failed to win the public support in recent years. I mean, the best example, of course, is the Voice to Parliament referendum, which he was very much behind, which was the idea of prioritising Indigenous voices in certain aspects of politics, which people saw as racially divisive, very much against the Australian spirit, to give more weight to one voice on the basis of their racial heritage than to another voice. And that was voted down by 60% of people, I think, including in many Labour seats. So how is it? And referendums are often a good measurement of where a government is at. So when Leo Varadkar lost his referendum on rewriting the Irish Constitution, he was out. When David Cameron catastrophically lost the Brexit referendum here in the UK, which was a great day for Britain, he left. How is it that Albanese could do something so unpopular and suffer such a defeat and then come back at the federal election?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Brendan, because if you go back to that referendum, which was only 19 months ago, like a year and a half, it was so people can place it in their minds. It was October the 14th, 2023, which always strikes me as very ominous because it came a week after that other event, which everybody has etched on their minds. So it was recent and it was crushing. Peter Dutton for the coalition came out for the no case. They made a very strong case that it was un-Australian to give certain groups of Australians special representation to Parliament simply on the grounds of their biology, on the grounds of their race. You know, that's very much against how Australians think of themselves and of one another. They talk about First Nations people here now. Well, the logical flow on from that is that the rest of us, because I can't claim any Aboriginal heritage, you can probably hear from my accent, I'm originally from England, but, you know, I can't claim Aboriginal heritage, so that makes me Second Nations people. Australians are not prepared to stand up for that. So it was a crushing defeat, 60-40, with Peter Dutton for the Liberal Party on the right side. So it's an enormous question. How did he go from a 60% vote to 30 or 32% in that period? And that'll take some time to work out. But I think essentially it was an easier ask with the voice because it was one isolated question. And you knew, if you knew the Australian people, that they would want to vote no to it. Just as today, and this is a great mystery, how the woke ideology gets away with so much, because you know, Brendan, if you were to hold a referendum here on what is a woman, we know exactly it would be more than 60-40, right? Or if we were to hold a referendum on should we make Australia great again, it'll be enormous. But that was the, you know, when actually when Jacinta Price, who you know, you've had her on your show, made that comment, make Australia great again, you know, they came down on her like a ton of bricks from the woke press saying, oh, you're just mirroring Donald Trump, and she had to retract it. So, yeah, I think a referendum was a great opportunity to show what people really think without muddying the waters. Maybe we should have more of them.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with that. I'm a big fan of referendums since Brexit, although I think the political class here has gone off them for exactly the same reason. Okay, you said there that they came down on Jacinta Price like a ton of bricks, and they did. She's a great politician. I'm a big fan of hers. So let's talk about who these people are. So, and I guess the broader question of who Labour really represents these days, or who it speaks to or speaks for. You know, listeners will be very familiar with what's happened to the Labour Party here in the UK and what's happened to social democratic parties across Europe, which is that they've often become, you know, the playthings of the kind of credentialed classes, the university graduates. They've lost more and more working class support. Working class voters are looking to other parties, including parties of the populist right or parties like Nigel Farage's Reform Party. Is there a similar development in Australia where the working classes are moving around and are not as attached to Labour as they might have been? And who is Labour speaking for these days down under?
Yeah, well, they're not speaking for the working people, Brendan. It is a very similar dynamic to Britain. So they used to speak to the working people, have a historic attachment to affiliation with the trade unions, as in Britain, which is still there. But of course, the trade unions now don't really speak for the working people either. Their membership is down in the single figures in the private sector here. So there's a few privileged sectors of workers like miners and others who can basically, and construction workers who can command huge wages and run these huge scams because they're some of the few that have stayed in these cartels. But, you know, the Labour there's been a battle in Labour which you can almost pinpoint to 1967, which is when Gough Whitlam got elected as Labour leader. People know their history. When the intellectual wing of the Labour Party, and I use the word intellectual not meaning in any way other than they're just, you know, stemmed largely from the universities, really started to challenge the domination of the industrial wing. And that battle has been a ding-dong battle, and the intellectual win has won commandingly. So if you go through the ranks of Labour MPs these days, everybody's got a degree. Most of them have got a degree in the law. I haven't been through the latest lot, but you'd be hard-pressed to find four or five who've got a trade certificate, i.e., you know, they're plumbers or electricians, so they can actually do that kind of job. And you tend to find more of those people in the Liberal Party now. So it's been a complete inversion, really, over the last 20 years. That, you know, now, for instance, if you have a plumber or you get picked up by a taxi driver, you just assume they're voting Conservative. You are 99% of the time right. I mean, I stood on polling booths. We have this institution of how to vote cards because our voting system is so complicated. You have to give how to vote cards. And I was giving those out for the Liberal Party. And you'd see people approach if they had a high-vis jacket on or, you know, Lunston boots, which are the working man's boots, you knew they were coming to you. If it was a 20-something woman with, you know, a little patterned jersey, you knew they were going to go straight to the Greens or Labour. It is a complete reversal.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my latest book. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and it's available right now from Amazon. I'm really proud of this book. It is an unflinching account of how the West failed the moral test of 7th of October 2023, which of course is the day that Hamas and other militants invaded Israel and unleashed barbarism. The book documents in pretty chilling detail how activists, academics, and others in the West ended up making excuses for Hamas's violence, ended up taking the side of the pogromists against the pogrom's victims, and ended up in the process turning their backs on the values of civilization. The book is fundamentally a call to arms for Western civilization. It makes the case for restoring Enlightenment values and standing with Israel while it's under attack by radical Islamists. I don't know if an author is allowed to describe his own book as essential reading, but I really do think it's essential reading. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and you can get your copy right now from Amazon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that sounds very similar to the UK. You could make exactly the same judgment. You could judge books by their covers in a similar way here when it comes to certain voting habits. What is the extent of the wokeness in Australian Labour? You know, the Labour Party here is struggling with it at the moment. It's trying to move away from some of the crazier positions that it's held, especially Keir Starmer's famous failure to say what a woman is or to say whether or not a woman can have a penis. You know, we've had the Supreme Court ruling. It seems to have clarified that issue for these politicians who apparently needed judges to tell them what a woman is. What's it like in Australian Labour? I mean, you talked there about the voice to Parliament, which suggests that Labour was completely infected by the politics of identity and the politics of racial difference, which is worrying. What are they like on the trans issue, other issues related to wokeness? Are they just deep in the weeds of all that, or is there a recognition on their part that a vibe shift?
They are. I think we're fortunate here, well, fortunate or unfortunate, in that we had another party on the left, the Greens Party, which are way out on the fruitcake fringe. So they sucked up a lot of that really weird stuff. And Anthony Albanese is at least cluey enough to know that he has to be careful about this stuff because it goes down like a little, particularly after the voice referendum. So they are cautious and they won't go out on a limb on that stuff, but they do all the same things. I mean, they're obsessed with identity politics at every level. And they've also got that other horrible woke trait of censoriousness. So they tried to pass a disinformation bill. I don't even have to describe that to you, Brendan. You know where they're heading with that. And that didn't get up the first time, but they'll no doubt have another go. They had a bill to Parliament to make discrimination against people on the grounds of their religion illegal. That's a tricky one to get through, and I wish we didn't need it, but since there's, you know, the same discrimination for everything else except religion, we do need it. They didn't try very hard to get that through, and they say they're not going to do it now, you know, because they really don't like religion or faith or anything like that. So they've got a lot of the same traits. The big thing here, the big issue here where they does show up, of course, is on climate and energy policy. So they've gone overboard with emissions targets, the zero 2050 thing, which I see that Tony Blair has now come out and said it's problematic. Well, they should listen to that. But no, there are people in the party unbelievably pushing for 70% emissions by 2035, which it'd be suicidal for the Australian economy, even if we could meet it. So when you see what's happening in Spain and Portugal over the last few weeks, that's been barely reported in the woke press here. A lot of us have covered it and looked at it because it is a clear demonstration that you can have too much renewables, but they're not listening to any of that. They're still off in la la land, and energy policy here is very much in the hands of the political class and the ideologues, not where it should be, in the hands of the engineers.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the climate question, because I think that plays out more interestingly in Australia than almost anywhere else in the Western world. Australia is an incredibly resource-rich country. You have a great mining industry. Some people take pride in the fact in what Australia does with its natural resources and how it transforms them into energy. But then, of course, you go to these circles that you're talking about in certain cities, in certain areas, and there's a great sniffiness about all of this, you know, about digging for coal, burning coal, using any form of natural resource. You know, we have to pay our penance for that by reducing emissions and so on. Where does the climate question now stand in Australia? Because I know that one of the issues in the election was cost of living, cost of energy bills, which Labour promised to bring down but failed to. What's the cause of failures like that, and what discussion is it giving rise to?
This was on the table at the last election, because the Liberal Party, one of the great things that Peter Dutton did as Liberal leader is he actually tackled the nuclear taboo. So no party had come out advocating nuclear power, which is illegal as it now stands in Australia. It's absurd. You know, we've got, I think, one third of the world's uranium here. But to use it to generate power is illegal, actually literally illegal. So Peter Dutton came out and said that this was nuts. He would lift it and we would have a new nuclear power program, building 7 nuclear power stations, basically one for each capital city. And that would have helped a great deal. But there was massive opposition from Labor, but not just Labor. And this is, I think, a very important part of the Australian dynamic now is the renewable energy sector, which has grown very fat, very rich, almost completely on the back of government subsidies and preferential treatment. None of it on the ground of profits for actually producing electricity. It's all on the renewable energy certificates and everything else they're given to give them a privileged start. And this began, it actually began under the John Howard government in the early 2000s, but was sent turbocharged by Labor in between 2007 and 2013. And they've grown and grown and grown. They are now very powerful and very rich, and so rich and so influential, in fact, that they've established their own party. They have their own, essentially what it acts as a party, the Teals, who are funded. And you can follow the funding train here. It's all disclosed. This isn't a conspiracy theory. They're funded by a group largely called Climate 200, which is run by a bloke called Simon Holmes Accord. And it is entirely dedicated to channeling money, much of which comes from overseas. It's not very transparent, to knock off the idea that we would have nuclear power, because they know if we introduce nuclear power here, that's it. That would halve the amount of their value of their investments right away, because we'd have a 24-hour reliable synchronous form of power. So it's taken some of us to wake up to this, but this is a massive factor in Australian politics now, because we're talking about such enormous sums of money being pumped in for these Teal candidates who look, you know, they're called community independents. They're almost all women. They look like nice women who just care about the planet and their children's lunch boxes. But behind it is this massive funding operation that's turned Australian politics on its head and made it very hard for the Liberals to get elected, because they lost last election 6 of their key seats to this group. They've actually won at least one back. I think our mutual friend Tim Wilson, you remember, in Goldstein, has won his seat back from a Teal, which is terrific. That's fresh off the press today. And they'll possibly win one more. So there's a pushback. But when Peter Dutton said he'd go for nuclear, he's not just taking on the Labor Party, he's taking on this massive moneyed a political group of rent seekers who are ruthless in just doing anything they can to stop any threat to their subsidies. That's essentially what it is. It sounds brutal, but having looked at this and looked into it for a long time, I can come to no other conclusion. This is money from the renewable energy sector is having a massive influence on Australian politics.
Yeah, well, it was great to see Tim Wilson win his seat back. That was, and any listeners who don't know Tim Wilson should look him up. He's a very interesting young politician in Australia. Sticking with the energy question for a while, how does it divide amongst the public? I mean, is it the predictable divide where the more working class communities, especially in areas where there is a huge coal industry or there are lots of jobs that are reliant on that industry, there's support for it there. There's support for the idea that Australia should remain a kind of energy strong nation. Whereas when you go to, I guess, you know, the trendy parts of Melbourne or certain parts of Sydney, there is that sniffiness, isn't there? There is that, I guess, unworldliness about how things are produced and how energy is created, and this notion that you can just cancel it all out. You can have net zero emissions. You can become a 70% zero emissions country or 100%, and that kind of cluelessness. Is that the divide that exists on the climate question?
Well, on the climate question, yeah, I think that's right. There's a huge energy illiteracy. I have to keep reminding myself, I mean, because of my former job at the Menzies Research Centre, I've been forced to spend much of the last 10 years, probably 15 years, immersed in energy policy. So I keep having to remind myself that other people haven't had to do that. So, I mean, what seems so obvious to me and all the sort of serious grid engineers and nuclear scientists, all these people that I end up talking to as part of my job, it just becomes so obvious that we have to have a baseload power source. And if we're going to turn up our nose at coal, I don't think we should, incidentally. We should continue burning coal. But some people are troubled by that. So if we can't do that, it has to be nuclear. You know, going back to Spain and Portugal last week, you know what happened there. And I was listening to Spanish radio with my bad. It was so interesting to find out what was going on. But essentially what was going on there was what they've been predicting here would happen here once you put too many renewables in the system. You cannot run a system on 100% renewables, which is what Australia is trying to do. Germany's tried to do it. Spain tried to do it. And now I think they'll probably change their mind and keep their nuclear open, because you have to have synchronous power. It has to be running steady 50 hertz. And I've kind of got my head around that, but it seems that most of the population haven't. They kind of in this sort of green energy sort of dream la-la land, you know, and they don't kind of think, well, hang on, what are the engineers saying? Is it, we set these wild targets, but do the engineers actually agree that's possible? At some point, you should surely be checking in with the people that have got to make this work. But they don't, of course, they're the elite. They're the anointed ones. They think they know everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, no need to check in with people who actually get things done. Okay, let's talk about the Greens, the Australian Greens, because there is a silver lining to this federal election, which is that the Greens have done very badly, I understand. Have they lost most of their seats in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and they've pretty much been wiped out? Can you explain what's happening with the Greens?
Yeah, well, voting here takes, to complete the count takes about a fortnight. We're now only into half a week into it. So that's still going through. But as things stand, significantly today, the news came through that Adam Bandt, who is the leader of the Greens, has lost his seat. He was on, I think, something like he had about a 7 or 8% margin. That's disappeared. It's gone. As things stand at the moment, two Green MPs in Queensland have lost their seats, and another one has lost their seat. So they have four. They may, when the counting comes through, get one back, but they're a severely weakened force in the lower house and in the upper house. So they won't have that influence. And this is very important because, they're not really a party about the environment anymore. They started out as that. Their big issue in the last 18 months or 19 months has been Gaza. They've been viciously anti-Israel. They've been siding with the Jew haters. They've been out on the streets chanting River to the Sea and all that terrible stuff. They've just gone weird, and I think that's partly why they've been punished, because they've gone far beyond the pale for most voters, and they've lost a lot of those sort of tree-hugging people that started out with them. But more than that, there's been, and this has been going on without too many people knowing, there's been a very clever campaign by a group called Advance, which are a centre-right pressure group that run on social media. And they had a deliberate campaign to get rid of all the Green MPs. It looks like they've succeeded, at least three or four of them. Plus the other thing that happened, and this is going into the weeds of our dreadful preferential voting system, that the Liberal Party took a principled stand and put the Greens last on their ticket. Normally there's a bit of horse trading going on and they'll do it tactically so they can make sure Labour doesn't get up or whatever. This time they made a decision that the Greens just could not be supported. They were last. So that helped see them off too. But the net result is very good. Now we've just got to deal with the hidden Greens, the ones in the Labour caucus, because of course there's many people within the Labour caucus who probably joined the Labour Party because they'd rather be in government, but they've got very similar views.
Sticking with the Greens just for a moment, whenever I've encountered them in Australia, I was on Q&A on the ABC with one of the Greens leaders once. They've never struck me as particularly pleasant people. I don't mean that in a morally judgmental way, but I mean in political terms, they're either banging the drum on the environment, of course, and putting forward policies that I think would be destructive to many working class people's lives in terms of cutting back on energy and raising costs. But also they have always had this tendency towards a kind of divisive identity politics, to the extremes of wokeness. And as you say, over the past year and a half, that's taken the form of just Israelophobia. I mean, just in kind of obsession with the supposed evil of Israel. You say that that might have hurt them. How is that issue? Because that has become a very serious problem in Australia. We had Alex Rivkin on the pod recently talking about the problems that Jews in Australia are facing right now. Did that impact on the election? Did it come up, or was it just more of a kind of background music to how people were thinking?
Oh, it did. It did have a big impact on the election. There are certain seats where there is a large Jewish population, Wentworth in Western Sydney being one, and there was a marked swing there away from the Teals and the Greens and Labour, because Labour's been shocking on this issue. So I was told, for instance, that about 12,000 people in the Jewish community in this seat of Wentworth, which is, people will know it, it's the one that goes from south of the harbour from Sydney to Bondi Beach. You can imagine that, very leafy, the best, most wealthiest place in Australia, and some of the loveliest houses. And they've got about 12,000 Jews in that electorate. I was told that they would be voting 80 to 20 in favour of the coalition. Normally they'd be 50-50 or maybe even in favour of Labour because a lot of left-wing Jews, but this time they were going. So it was directly there, but I think it had a much broader impact, Brendan, because most people, although they may not be particularly invested in Israel or Israel's history, or they probably don't read too much about it, what they hate, what they really hate, are people that bring wars and troubles that are not our own into the country. It's kind of a golden rule of becoming a migrant here that you don't bring your historical grievances with you. And almost everybody obeys that. You know, we had a bit of trouble in the 70s and 80s between the Croats and the Serbs, but they kind of settled down. I mean, they got it after a while. You know, the Indians and the Pakistanis, very topical, of course, but they'll get on fine. Everybody does that. So this is one exception, and people really hated that. There was great discomfort about those massive choreographed anti-Israel rallies that were happening weekly and now thankfully have stopped. Purely because, not because people didn't have a right to protest and believe whatever they want, but just don't bring that stuff here. You came here for a peaceful existence. And interestingly, I've spent a fair bit of time with a Muslim candidate who out in Western Sydney, and he tells me that 9 out of 10 Muslims are the same. They just don't want it. There's just a small radical extreme. And I said to him one day, I said, "So, Sam," I said, what's the big issue with Muslim voters at this election?" And he looked at me like puzzled, and he said, "Well, cost of living, of course, you know." And I think we often forget that, and I think we've got to kind of remember that when we talk broadly about Muslims. It's really this radical fringe that feel empowered and reinforced by their alliance with the radical left-wingers in the universities.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same here. The vast majority of Muslims in the UK just want to work for a living and get on with their lives. But, you know, there is an Islamist fringe. And the bigger problem, of course, on the Israelophobic wing of politics is the kind of, you know, let's be frank about it, the kind of white upper middle classes, university educated, left-leaning. I mean, they're the ones who have this frothing hatred for Israel, which, and this very kind of vicarious hatred for Israel. And I think we've seen it similar in Australia as well. Okay, Nick, let's talk about the Liberal Party then, or the Liberal National Coalition. So the Liberal Party, the coalition didn't win. They did badly. The Liberal Party itself did badly too, including Peter Dutton, you've mentioned already. Peter Dutton was the leader of the Liberal Party. he lost his own seat in Dixon in Brisbane, which a seat he had for 25 years, I think, or a long time. That has got to be a huge blow for him personally and for the party politically when the leader himself gets ousted from his seat. What impact has that had? What impact has Dutton's misfortunes had? And what do they tell us about the broader problems in the Liberals?
Yeah, I mean, I think Peter is probably, I haven't spoken to him since he's lost. I will do when things calm down a bit. I suspect he's quietly relieved, because the last thing you want to be is to come in after a defeat of that magnitude and have to, you know, have to give up the leadership and then have to sit on the back bench and just be, I've seen that happen with previous leaders, with Tony Abbott, and it's not a pleasant thing to do. So he'd be really, but look, the party is in, this is probably the worst point ever in their history. They've been founded in 1944. They've certainly never polled as low as they did. They've never had such a low primary vote. And they finish up with 40, 45 members in the 150-seat parliament. So they're a tiny, like the Conservatives, a much reduced force. There's a lot of, right now, it's quite visceral, the factional, what is largely factional rivalry going on, but dressed up in high-minded terms. You know, we need to have more women in the party. That would solve it. We need to have quotas for women. We need to be, you know, all this sort of stuff, which is really just a proxy war for factional interests. So whoever takes over is going to be in a very difficult position. The favourite is Angus Taylor, he's an Oxford scholar. He's very much like Keir Starmer in a sense. He's a tremendously smart guy. He's the smartest guy in any room that I've ever been in with him. But he's on the Conservative side, so he's under attack. There's a lot of viciousness going on. And if I got to talk to him, I'd say, I wonder if you really want the job, mate. You know, I mean, maybe is it worth it? Because it's such a difficult job to pick up when you would, you know, conventional wisdom says you'd be out for at least two terms, which is 6 years here. I think realistically that's doesn't necessarily apply now, because of all the things we said, politics is so changing and so uncertain that they shouldn't give up the hope of getting in next time. But at the base, you know, it's still a very conservative country. It's just they're not voting for the Liberals, very much like the Conservatives. I mean, you can correct me on this, but I remember looking at the British election last year and thinking, well, yeah, sure, the Conservatives lost voters to Farage. But I think on the numbers, I'm right in saying they actually lost no more voters to a party that you might call apathetic, i.e. the Conservatives who either didn't turn out or cast their vote for some other thing. That's exactly what happened here. So we have compulsory voting, of course. So in theory, they have to turn up. But what I've noticed is there's a massive decline in the turnout rate, even though people threatened with a fine, and a lot of spoiled ballots. You know, what people do is they turn up, tick off their name, and then go and screw on the ballot paper. Normally only 3-4%, but it's 20% in some seats. So my sense, and the fact that they've gone for a lot of sort of fringe center right fringe parties, it's that they want to vote for Labour, but they weren't ready to vote for the Liberals. Liberals hadn't made the case. And you'd have no more. But that's very much what happened to the Conservatives last time. If they'd kept up their vote, they could have beaten it was the fall in their vote that handed the election to Starmer rather than any great increase in his side. And that's exactly the dynamic here.
This year, Spiked is celebrating its 25th birthday. 25 years ago, Spiked was a pioneer of online political journalism. And now we are bigger than ever. We're reaching people around the world with our articles, essays, videos, and podcasts, all underpinned by our principled message of freedom, democracy, and progress. This would never have happened without you. our listeners, readers, and supporters. Your donations fund our work and your enthusiasm spreads the word about it. So as we mark Spike's 25th birthday, we want to say a heartfelt thank you. And we're asking those who can afford it to donate to our anniversary appeal in order to keep Spike going and growing into the future. We also have a very special offer on at the moment. Those who donate £25 or more will get a year's membership to Spike Supporters, our online donor community, where you can comment on articles, come to events, and read the site ad-free. This is half of what you'd normally pay for a year's membership. And if you're already a Spike supporter, you can benefit from this offer too. Just make a donation of £25 or more and we'll extend your membership by 12 months. So if you want to support Spiked and get access to some brilliant exclusive perks, go to spiked-online.com/donate. That's spiked-online.com/donate. And donate £25 or more to help keep us going for another 25 years. That's very well put. Yeah, the implosion of the Tories was the key dynamic in our general election last year. And the apathy party was a big winner, and it often is in elections. And I know that plays out differently in Australia. And
I might, if I could just take over your podcast from home, Brendan. I think it is worth looking at Canada. So Canada had an election just 5 days before we did. Very different result. I mean, pre-election in Canada, they were in the same position we were, you know, roughly one third for each of the major parties and then one third for the minor parties, you know, for the Bloc Québécois and the LDP and so forth. But that has changed dramatically in Canada. The primary vote there, 85% voted for one of the two major parties. Both parties had a massive increase into the 40s for their popular vote. So what happened there? They were actually, both parties were playing into the nationalist narrative, obviously, with the threat of terrorists from Trump. But that has raised great hopes here. You sort of say, well, it doesn't have to be this way. It's not an inevitable trend towards a sort of, you know, multi-party system on the European style. If parties have got the guts actually to speak directly to the public and say what they're thinking and connect with them, we can turn this around, because I think that's what's happened in Canada.
That's an interesting way of seeing it. And it taps into what I wanted to ask you about the Liberal Party and where they might be going wrong, because it seems to me that, again, I don't want to make too many British comparisons, because Australia is its own country and it has a very distinctive form of politics and a distinctive voting system. But it seems to me that, like the Tories, that there are some people in the Liberal Party in Australia who've got some good ideas, some good policies, but aren't always very good at pushing them. So, I mean, look at the woke question. So, as you said, Peter Dutton and the Liberals took a good position on the Voice to Parliament referendum. They said, no, we're not in favour of it. And that was a great victory for that side of the discussion. But then if you look at the Moira Deeming issue in the Victorian Liberal Party, where Moira Deeming was ousted for associating with Kelly J. Keene and the gender critical feminism and so on. And there was a lot of scorn heaped on the Victorian wing of the Liberal Party for how it handled that. And people said they made too many concessions to this woke lunacy. And so that it was a kind of, as an outside observer, it felt that the Liberals didn't quite know how to handle issues like these and made a good fist of it on some questions and not so much on others. Is that one of the problems? They don't have a kind of moral political consistency on questions that are important to the public?
They're confused. That's right, exactly right. On the Moira Deeming question, you had a very good interview with her. You've covered that issue. The Liberal Party, if you'll excuse the pun, didn't know whether it was Arthur or Martha on this one. So it seemed to me that it was quite obvious where we would stand as Conservatives, but not apparently to other members of the party. So I think, you know, the big high-level picture here is what you and I have been talking about for a long time, that the real political dynamic, the fault line in modern politics, is not between some notional left and right, conservative, Labour, working class, middle class, upper class. That's just not the way it works. It is between the insiders and the outsiders. It's between the people that Thomas Sowell calls the anointed and the benighted. That's as Thomas Sowell characterized it in 1995. And I reread that book recently and he nailed it. You know, that's it. There's the people who come out with university degrees and think that because they're experts in political science or some, then they're experts in everything. So then they can decide energy policy for us without realizing that actually those are very practical things that need very different skills than they have. It's this sort of contempt. We've gone about this over and over again in many different contexts. We've had these conversations, but that's the new political dynamic. And neither party has learned how to straddle both sides. But the beautiful thing about the voice debate, to go back to that, is that that was a very clear split. And the people that voted no to the voice weren't just voting no to this one particular narrow constitutional amendment. They were voting no to the whole shooting match. It was a no to identity politics, the whole thing. It was their one chance to voice their opinions on it, when normally they're silenced, and they did it. So it seems to me when the Liberal Party can just go back to that, common sense, but it's not really a one class against the other. It's just the basic Liberal Party philosophy, which is you respect every individual. Every individual deserves equal respect. If you go back to that, then you can break away from this horrible sort of politics of hatred and goodies and baddies and, you know, black hats and white hats, you know, the kind of stuff that goes on now. You're either moral or you're not moral, or you're immoral. We need to go back to the way the Liberal Party was originally founded, the principles under which it was founded, and we can break through that. And I think using that, we can really undermine the whole woke establishment.
Yeah, yeah. In relation to another issue, it seems to me that the Liberal Party had, or maybe still has, who knows how they'll come out of this, is that even where they have good policies, they didn't always do a good job of presenting them to the public or being forceful enough. I like a forceful politician who is unapologetic and speaks plainly to people. So as I understand it, the Liberal Party had some pretty good views on nuclear energy and the promotion of it and saying, you know, let's go for it. Let's take the shackles off this form of energy creation and go for it. They were also took a pretty good stand against Labour's strangling of the mining industry and other policies like that. But it didn't seem that they always were as tub-thumping as you might like them to be, or as someone like you or I might be if we were in a public forum talking about these questions. Is that fair? Do they sometimes think well but don't present well?
Yeah, well, Peter Dutton was doing marvellously up until about March. He was leading the polls, which is amazing. You think March he was leading the polls and now we've had this crushing historic defeat. What went wrong in the meantime? Well, the campaign team stepped in. And the polling and the focus groups. And suddenly, you know, I thought, that's not the Peter Dutton we've seen for the last 3 years. I can see the whites of his eyes now. He's just pulling back. He's very cautious. He won't say this. Why isn't he unveiling this policy, which I knew they had tucked in their back pocket? And that's the story of this election and why he left so badly, is that he just became very cautious and very focus group driven. So they wouldn't push a policy because I thought it might go down badly with women 26 to 34, say, and they were, you know, there were a lot of women in that bracket in certain seat they were trying to target. You can't run a campaign like that. It was a huge mistake. You know, the history here is when you're in from opposition, you come out like a whirling dervish. You know, you just keep going. You just don't allow your opponents to get their sights on you because you've moved on and you come out with something else. That's what Tony Abbott did when he came in with the landslide in 2013. It's what Scott Morrison did when he won the miracle election in 2019. But in the last two elections, we've gone back to allow the focus groups and the polling and the technocrats to run the election. And as I think the big lesson is that that can be a political death, particularly up against a Labour Party leader who is ruthlessly political. And one other thing I should point out about this, and I wrote a column about this, is the first post-truth election Australia's ever had. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese told lie after lie after lie, and I use those words cautiously. They were lies. They were factual mistruths. He misquoted figures. He's got numbers wrong. He said things that weren't true. And whereas normally you'd beg them to be picked up and they then have to retract, not this time. He just repeated it and repeated it and repeated it. So, for instance, he said that the opposition's nuclear program would cost $600 billion and that therefore they'd have to cut money from the health budget to pay for it. Complete fiction, absolute fiction. But he just said it over and over again, even when he was challenged. He kept saying it. And I've never seen anything like it, Brendan. I mean, you expect politicians to push the truth sometimes. But just this barefaced lie that he must have known was a lie, and he would not relent. He said it oft more. The more he said it, the more it kind of sunk into the public imagination. It would be reinforced with all sorts of social media campaigns and text message campaigns. It's a new kind of politics in my mind. But I think it stems from this, you know, this idea, which a lot of young people actually believe. There's no such thing as objective truth, my truth and your truth. And that's what's crept in. And we've got people now in their 20s who've been through all this rubbish at universities, actually don't think there's an objective truth. So it doesn't really matter what the Prime Minister says. I just felt there's a worrying turn.
Yeah, well, you know, we've just had protests on the streets here in Britain because the Supreme Court said that men are men and women are women. So we really do live in a post-truth era.
It's a prime example. That whole transgender thing is in the same bracket. And we're there with energy policy, incidentally, too. You know, I mean, any engineer will tell you that wind and solar and hydro are not baseload power, and you need baseload power. But they say, no, wind and solar and hydro are baseload, and they keep saying it, but that's exactly, they're denying the laws of physics, just as the transgender lobby deny the laws of biology. They just seem to think that that's okay.
That's very well put. Yeah, and it's striking how it's often the politicians and the parties that most want to clamp down on misinformation who also seem pretty wedded to their own forms of misinformation. You know, there's a striking contradiction there. Okay, Nick, to finish, let's talk about, the bigger picture. We've mentioned Britain a lot. You've mentioned Canada. What's going to happen with the two-party system? It was interesting to hear you say there that it might not be a bad thing if that were to get back on track. And in the piece that you wrote for Spiked prior to the election in Australia, you talked about how the two-party system was the great stabilizing force in the Westminster system of politics. And the two-party system is under fire. It's under fire hugely here in the UK. We've just had our local elections and Nigel Farage's Reform Party did superbly well. It was a real body blow to the two-party system, which I think could well change politics here over the next few years. Despite the victory of Labour in Australia, the two-party system there does seem to be withering. And I think if you add together the Labour vote of 34% and the Liberal vote of 32%, you get 66%, which I understand is the lowest number that the two big parties have ever received. And that's similar things are happening in different parts of the Western world. Do you see that as a negative thing, or do you think it's a kind of insurgency of ordinary people saying, look, well, the two parties aren't doing what we want, so we're going to ask for more parties?
Well, number one, I think the Westminster system is the best form of government there is. We might both agree on that. I think we inherited this from the UK and we've improved it here, I happen to think, but it's what they've got in Canada and New Zealand. It's a very stable form of government. It's served us very well, so you don't want to be chucking it out. But I think that the multi-party thing doesn't really work very well at all. And so, it doesn't work in a fair way. I mean, Farage, of course, should have had many more seats than they actually ended up with. But the whole first-past-the-post, the two-party system mitigate against that. It does in Australia in a different way. We have this preferential voting that's supposed to sort that out. But it, as you say, this election, you can see it's way out of kilter. So it's not working. I was very interested. I spent a lot of time in Europe rather than the UK last summer, you know, during the European elections. And it seems to be working quite well in Europe. You know, you take, say, Sweden or Finland or just about any country you want, and you've got multi-party coalitions in government that are actually sometimes very effective, you know, that they each bring their own strengths and they cancel out the other's weak points. And they work. You know, it would be very unusual in Finland, for instance, to expect one party to come in as the clear winner in any election. It's usually two or three parties having to get together and work out what's in the national interest. That's fine in their system, but that doesn't work in the Westminster system, or not easily. So I think if we want to stick with the Westminster system, I think we have to force the discipline that you may not agree with somebody, but going off and forming another party is just simply a waste of effort because you're going to struggle to get into power. That said, I think there's a very interesting experiment going on in the UK now, and let's see how this turns out. You know, can Farage turn Reform into a serious, stable party with democratically, you know, internally democratic? That's a crucial thing. So it's not sort of a top-down thing. That becomes a third force in British politics. If that happens, I'll have to think again, but I somehow can't see it. I think at some point there's got to be some rapprochement between the Conservatives and Reform forces, or we'll never get a Conservative government in Britain again.
Yeah, I think that I guess one of the big questions for the Westminster system countries anyway is, you know, what do you want it to do? Do you want to radically improve the two parties, whether that's the Conservative Party or the Labour Party, or do you think they're lost causes and that we need another instrument to make our presence felt? And, you know, I'd be all in favour of a Conservative Party here that was properly Conservative and a Labour Party that actually represented people who labour. But at the moment, we don't have either of those things. Kemi Badenoch is doing a pretty good fist of trying to get the Conservative Party back on track, but it is a party that's drastically lost its way. And Labour, of course, has nothing to do with Labour anymore and has become a kind of an outlet for the woke elites. So I guess that's the big question. And it seems to me that you're very keen on improving the Liberal Party in Australia, which you think can be done. Whereas I think over here, people have probably thought, well, you've let us down so often, both of you parties, that we're going to take a punt on a third party, even though we recognise that might be quite disruptive to the system we've had here for a long time.
I suppose I go back to first philosophical principles here and say, well, you know, I'm a conservative in the Edmund Burke school. I mean, I don't believe in knocking everything down and starting again French Revolution style. So I'd be very, very loath to, abandon the major parties, no matter how bad they get. Surely, you know, in a civil society, if I think the major parties are off beam, then it is my duty as a citizen to join one and try and work within it to get them back on track. If that's the way it's always worked here. But now, of course, with social media and, you know, the general fracturing of society, that's harder and harder to make work. People say, oh, bugger it, I'll go and set up a new party. And of course, they faff around, really. They might win a seat here and there, but they're never going to change the world. There's only two players on the field. So I'm going to stick with it. And the other thing, of course, in the history of the Liberal Party, very different from the Conservative Party. It's a newish party. It only started in 1944. And it was expressly founded by Robert Menzies, its sort of intellectual leader at that time. It was expressly founded to bring together the splintered, balkanized parties on the centre-right, the non-Labour parties. That's what he did. And since then, the centre-right here has been ascendant. It's been in power probably at least 60% of the time since World War II, since the party was founded. So I'm not prepared to abandon that. I'm going to stick with it. I every now and then I think, what's the threshold issue where I walk away from them? And every now and then they get close to it, but we haven't reached it quite yet, I must admit. So, yeah, I'm going to stick with it until it's totally useless. Others take a different view. But, let's see where we go.
Yeah, I think, for all the things that you and I have agreed on over the years, and there are many things, if not most things, I think when it comes to that Edmund Burke Thomas Paine divide. I'm more on the side of Paine, you're more on the side of Burke. Yeah. I like to, every now and then, I think things need a really good shake-up. And that kind of brings me into my last question for you, which is the prospects of populism in Australia. It's a difficult one for me to read because I've always, I think it was you who put me onto the D.H. Lawrence observation of Australia, which is that it's a very proletarian country fundamentally, and people don't like to do what they're told, or they just presume that they shouldn't have to do what they're told. That's been its history. Obviously, things have changed in recent years. So in one sense, you think to yourself, well, maybe Australia doesn't need populism because it has that kind of have-a-go spirit anyway, which I guess at some level must limit politicians taking the piss out of the public because there's that instinctive pushback. Or does Australia need an injection of populism? Does it need a more explicit Brexit moment? I know you've had it with the voice referendum and so on. Does it need a Trump-like figure? Does it need some kind of party or person that can sweep in and say, well, things aren't working, let's shake it up a bit?
I think I'm a believer in you remember the old Groucho Marx quote, you know, these are my principles. If you don't like those, I've got some others, you know. And that I think you have abiding principles that never change. Your policies change, your approach changes to suit the moment. But unless you've got those, you know, you're anchored in those abiding principles, then you're just a weather vane. Now, what happens if you get somebody on the center right, if you end up with a leader who doesn't have those abiding principles? You get Donald Trump. What about if you end up in Australia with a party that is not really clear about those abiding principles and doesn't have somebody of the charisma and nerve and bravado of Donald Trump? Well, you get Anthony Albanese, a Labour leader. So I don't think the solution here is to go, I don't want to see a Trump-style figure, even if they manage to sort of overcome all the hurdles and get into power. We don't have, our government doesn't work that way. You know, we don't give executive power to prime ministers. They've got to argue the way through with parliament and their own caucus. So I think the future of the party is just to go back to basic principles. And I'm not talking about very much that's complicated. It would be all the things that you and I would absolutely agree on, that everybody deserves equal opportunity and equal chance, that individuals should control their lives, not government, as far as we can. There's nothing controversial or difficult in this, but we need to have a grasp of those things so that when something comes out of left field, like the transgender issue, we know automatically where we stand on that question. We don't have this total confusion, which happens every 5 minutes.
Nick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brendan.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.